We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
This is Mark Reardon. Did you know that a major glacier in Greenland that had been melting at a rapid pace for years is now expanding again at the same pace that it contracted? You probably don't, because most media coverage on climate change is so one-sided. Dr. Roy Spencer used to be a senior scientist for climate studies at NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center. He and his colleague, Dr. John Christie, even received NASA's Exceptional Scientific Achievement Medal for their global temperature monitoring work with satellites. But Dr. Spencer is not on the same side of the climate change ledger as the climate alarmists. And he'll explain it all in our discussion today on KMOX Profiles.
Welcome to Profiles. From entertainers to athletes, political leaders to entrepreneurs, Profiles gives you an insight into what has made these unique personalities who and what they are today. Now, Profiles on St. Louis's News Radio, KMOX.
Dr. Roy Spencer has been a guest of mine on my show for many, many years, and I thought that he would make a great KMOX profile, so he's with me on KMOX for the profile. How are you, Roy?
I'm doing good, Mark. Glad to be with you.
I always like our discussions, and we try to put this climate change stuff into perspective. We'll get into all of that throughout the course of this hour, but I like to start here on my profiles with a little This Is Your Life. And, you know, as many times as we've talked on the radio, I did not know that you went to school in the People's Republic of Wisconsin at UW-Madison.
Yeah, that's where I did my graduate work. My master's and PhD in meteorology were there. I started out at University of Michigan for my bachelor's degree in meteorology.
Where did you grow up?
Well, actually all over the place.
Yeah.
I started out in Pennsylvania and then Iowa and then went to Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan. And I guess the interesting part of my story is that when my mother died at a fairly young age, she actually died on my 13th birthday from cancer. We were in Iowa, and I was given the choice of either going to military school or going to live with my aunt and uncle in northern Michigan, and I chose to live with my aunt and uncle in Michigan. And when I moved there, I got interested in the lake effect snows we get there in the winter, and that was sort of the thing that got me involved in weather and led to my current job eventually. So if it weren't for my mother dying at an early age, I wouldn't even be in this business, I don't think.
Isn't that weird? That is, that's a strange turn of events. Now, did you ever, when you were younger, did you think about being a TV meteorologist or not? Was that something completely out of your mind?
I think I was more interested in weather forecasting. I was never that interested in being on TV because I can't force myself to smile that much.
Yeah. Hey, this is why I'm on the radio. That and how I look. But yes, you have to always smile and look pretty.
Yeah. So I had a mentor at the National Weather Service because I would work at the National Weather Service office in Sault Ste. Marie in the summers while I was going to school. And the guy that was in charge there, every time I got a degree, he said, okay, well, now you need to get your next degree. And then I'd get my next degree. And then he'd say, okay, now you need to go get your next degree. And I said, why? And he said, because the more degrees you have, the more control you'll have over your future. And he was the one that sort of kept me going and you know, encouraged me to do what I'm doing today.
So when he was listing those degrees, how many degrees do we have eventually?
Well, let's see, I guess three.
So it was the original bachelor, the master's, and then the
PhD. Yeah, which I never, you know, when I originally went to college at University of, actually I went to Michigan State my first year, and I thought I wanted to go into computer science. And within, you know, a couple months, I realized this is not for me, and I had to ask myself, what am I interested in? Because my dad was, I think, always unhappy in his job. And one thing I saw through him was that whatever I was going to do with my life, I didn't want to be as unhappy in what I did as he was in what he did. So I thought, what's the only thing that I've ever been interested in? And that was weather. And I thought, well, but can you actually get a job in weather? I thought,
right.
You know, you just don't people just walk in off the street and say, I'd like to do that TV meteorologist thing, or I want to work for the Weather Service. Can you hire me here? And no, you got to have education. And so I realized not only, you know, could you get just a bachelor's degree, but you could go as far as you wanted to in education in meteorology. And by the time I got through with all of that, people weren't as interested in weather as they were in climate change. And that's basically where people these days are earning their money. You know, for us old meteorologists, you go into climate change because that's where the money is.
So when did you go to work for NASA?
That was after I was in a postdoctorate program after I got my PhD at the University of Wisconsin. I spent a couple of years there doing some research for NOAA, and was given a talk at Goddard Space Flight Center, NASA Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland, and somebody from NASA here in Huntsville was there and said, how would you like to come work for us? And my wife said, sure.
She took the job before you did.
Yes, she did. She says, you can do what you want, Roy.
Right.
She says, but I'm moving to Alabama.
There you go, right? Well, believe me, we know how these things happen. So your role at NASA, you were at one point the senior scientist for climate studies. Was that how it began, or was that something that evolved?
Well, that was sort of an evolution. I started out at NASA working on a couple of different missions, trying to get an instrument flown on the shuttle, trying to get one on the space station. We developed one to fly in a NASA's U-2 high-altitude aircraft. And then John Christie and I did this global temperature monitoring with satellites thing. You know, we invented the method for doing that and found that these satellites that are used for weather monitoring, for weather forecasting purposes, could actually be used for climate monitoring, and that was sort of a big deal for us and led to us, you know, getting a NASA Achievement Award, a Scientific Achievement Award, and my manager ended up me getting this promotion to label you just mentioned,
yeah.
The Senior Scientist for Climate Studies.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned Dr. John Christie. He to this day, he's one of your research partners, right?
Yes, in fact, he's not only my research partner, he's my boss.
Oh, he's your boss? I don't know if I knew that.
Oh, yeah. Well, and better him than me, because he has to deal with all the things that go along with being a boss of dozens of scientists.
Now,
you know, as far as I'm concerned, that would be like herding cats.
Yes, that doesn't sound fun to me either. But when it comes to climate change now, obviously, now do you still do work for NASA or not? Is it completely separate?
For many years after I left NASA and went to the university, I was still the lead researcher on an instrument that flies on a spacecraft, a NASA spacecraft. And that, in the last year, that project has finally ended. So I am no longer funded by NASA as of about a year ago.
Fair to say, though, you and Dr. Christie aren't aligned with a good portion of the scientific community when it comes to climate change.
No, we're not. We're called deniers and all of that. And you know, it's just sort of a coincidence that we have like minds on this issue. Sort of a coincidence, I guess, that we ended up in Alabama, because in most universities we would probably not be allowed to do what we're doing. But you know, Alabama is still fairly conservative.
Yeah, is that the reason? Because of, you know, the different politics down there a little bit? You know, Maya, I don't know if you know Anthony Lupo, who's at the University of Missouri, but I've had him on many times. He's on your side, too.
Mm-hmm. But we're definitely in the minority.
More of Profiles coming up on KMOX. Now back to Profiles on St. Louis's News Radio, KMOX.
Dr. Roy Spencer is my guest on KMOX. He's an expert when it comes to climate change. He's got a great website, drroyspencer.com. Roy, let's get into the topic of climate change and global warming. It used to be called global warming. When did that all change?
You mean going from
yeah.
Global warming to climate change?
Yeah, right.
Well, you know, it's interesting. The public I talk to put a lot of emphasis on that. They say, you know, everything changed, you know, just because we didn't get enough warming, they changed it to climate change. Well, you know, we've, for decades, we've always use those terms interchangeably. The scientists have, you know, global warming, climate change, but it seems like the public thinks there's some large significance to going from, you know, from one term to the next. I don't think there's a whole lot of significance to attach to it.
I think that was a bit of a media thing, and I think the interpretation, I'll just give you my interpretation, was when there were questions about how much warming was taking place, then the shift became, well, it's not just warming, it's climate change, which to a certain degree that's accurate, right?
Yeah, that's true. It's always been not just about the warming, it's whether other aspects might change, whether, you know, you might get more storms, whether you might get more drought, things like that. It's all part of the same package.
So when Dr. Roy Spencer talks about climate change, you mentioned at the beginning of the profile, you know, you get accused of being a science denier and, you know, one of these folks that's a little crazy on this, but you would be what I would call myself to a certain extent is a lukewarmer. Would you accept that label?
I sometimes call myself a lukewarmer. That's right.
Well, so explain that to a certain extent, because you're not denying the science. You're not denying that the climate is changing and has changed and will continue to change. But your position on how much we've caused that with CO2 emissions is where it gets a little different.
Right. It's an interesting distinction, because it seems like in the public's mind, and I don't know whether this is true or not with all the public, but certainly a lot of the public, and certainly the media, and certainly environmentalists, they think you either believe in catastrophic, man-made global warming, or you're a denier that there's any climate change at all due to humans. But the fact is that those of us scientists who work in this business, who consider ourselves skeptics on the global warming issue, actually, we all believe that there is some influence of humans. It's just a question of how much. Generally speaking, the skeptical view on global warming is that humans probably have some warming influence on the climate system because of our carbon dioxide emissions. But that influence is relatively benign. It might even be beneficial. And that the role of nature in warming is largely being ignored, because we really don't understand what causes natural climate fluctuations. We know that it warmed naturally from, say, the 1700s to the 1900s. No one knows why. Okay.
Just to go on the record with that, I believe that was before giant SUVs were roaming the planet, correct?
Yes, I'm glad you pointed that out. Right. I usually assume that people know that.
Well, make sure.
Yeah. We really didn't produce much CO2 that could cause climate change until about World War II and later. Okay, there just wasn't enough CO2 produced by humanity to cause warming or climate change. And so that's why the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change basically talks about just climate change since the 1950s. And they say that they're quite sure that most of the warming that has occurred since the 1950s is due to humans. And guess what? I believe that too. I think probably most of the warming since the 1950s is due to humans. But there hasn't been nearly as much warming as the climate models claim. Plus, when they talk about the climate models explaining the warming since the 1950s, those models assume that all the warming is due to climate, whereas the IPCC has said in their words, not in their models, but in their interpretation of the models, that, hey, some of this warming could be natural. So when you factor in those things, that some of the warming could be natural, that the amount of warming we've seen has actually been fairly weak, it turns the whole climate thing from a crisis into a big sort of yawn.
You mentioned the IPCC. That's the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Explain what that group is and what they do.
Well, back in the 1980s, and this would be a whole other story that we could go into, there was a push by generally governments to put together a United Nations group of, led group of scientists from around the world to basically examine the role of humans in climate change. And as that IPCC evolved over the years, they gradually weeded out the scientists who didn't agree in sort of the catastrophic view of human-caused climate change, to where now it's just a bunch of believers that write reports every several years that come out with conclusions that, surprise, surprise, claim humans are causing, you know, dangerous global warming. So people like John Christie, that works with me, he was the lead author on the IPCC. But after it became clear to the IPCC that he was a skeptic, he was no longer invited to participate. And then you've got people like Chris Lancy at the National Hurricane Center. He's an expert in hurricanes. He was involved in the IPCC for years, and he finally resigned because they wanted him to say things about climate change affecting hurricanes that he didn't see in the data. So the IPCC, yes, it has, you know, hundreds, if not a couple thousand scientists involved in it, but they're all the true believers. They are not a representative cross-section of the scientists in the world on this issue.
How does James Hansen, you know, play a role in all of this?
Well, James Hansen, who was the director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies until he retired a few years ago, he became sort of the godfather of modern global warming hysteria, and it sort of started in 1988. We had a drought and heat wave going in 1988, and Al Gore was a senator who was on a science committee in the Senate who invited invited James Hansen to testify on the subject of global warming. And Hansen had some sort of statement that, you know, he had this conclusion that he was pretty sure that some of what we were seeing with that heat and drought of 1988 was due to humans. It was a very, like, milquetoast kind of conclusion with all kinds of layers of uncertainty. But it was, I still remember, you know, the news coverage of it. It was spun as, you know, NASA expert claims that this is the beginning of what weather is going to be like from now on in the United States because of human-caused climate change.
Dr. Roy Spencer is my guest on this KMOX profile. You mentioned something a few minutes ago may have caught some people's attention. We've talked about it before, but I want you to go into greater detail because you talked about how CO2 could perhaps be beneficial to the planet. Well, that would sound kind of contrary to what we hear from the alarmists.
Well, that's right. We usually don't hear about the benefits of more CO2. You know, CO2 in the atmosphere is a trace gas. It's 4 out of every 10,000 parts of the atmosphere now. You know, centuries ago, it was about 3 parts out of 10,000, and now it's 4 parts out of 10,000. The amount of CO2 that's in the atmosphere 100 or 200 years ago was just enough to keep vegetation going. In fact, I've had plant physiologists tell me that it's almost as if nature for centuries and millennia had been sucking on the CO2 in the atmosphere, which is needed for photosynthesis. It's needed for life on Earth. Okay, nature has been sucking on CO2 so hard that it sucked all it could out of the atmosphere and still stay alive. Well, now we're replenishing a lot of that CO2 back into the atmosphere, and there is global greening that's occurring. There are papers published, you know, in the peer-reviewed literature showing satellite data since the 1980s that where there's greening almost everywhere, especially in the semi-arid areas where vegetation was barely staying alive. It's been estimated that the increase in global agricultural productivity has been over $1 trillion just because of the increased amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. It makes plants more drought tolerant. It makes them more efficient in their water use. They grow faster. All plants, because all plants require CO2 for photosynthesis.
More of Profiles coming up on KMOX. Now back to Profiles on St. Louis's News Radio, KMOX.
Dr. Roy Spencer, my guest on this KMOX profile, has got a great blog at his website, drroyspencer.com. One of the things when it comes to climate change that's always a little bit mysterious to me, and you bring it up a lot, so we're going to talk about it, is the effect that some of the policies from the alarmists would have on poor people, not only in this country, but around the planet. Now, we hear these warnings from AOC and some of the other Democrat leaders in particular when it comes to the planet basically evaporating in 12 years. But look, there are real effects if we would go to the extremes in trying to reduce CO2 emissions that would have on everyone in this country, in poor people in particular. And the question that I've asked based on things that you've told me is, look, what about the people living in India or in third world countries that would love to have some air conditioning or some you know, some benefits of power. And they're not going to be able to get them under a Paris Climate Accord or some of these other extreme methods.
Yeah, it's interesting that the people that are the most adamant about us getting away from fossil fuels are those who have already benefited the most from fossil fuels. The way I phrase it to people is, abundant, affordable energy is necessary for everything humans do. Everything we do requires energy. Okay, it doesn't matter what it is, everything. And the more abundant and affordable that energy that is, then the greater prosperity we can achieve. Well, if wind and solar were just as practical and as inexpensive as fossil fuels, I would say, sure, let's switch to wind and solar or whatever other renewable energy source there is. The trouble is it's expensive, it's impractical. You still have to have fossil fuels as backup, you know, at night and when the wind doesn't blow. And so to the extent that you get away from fossil fuels with current technology, you increase poverty. So especially for people that are living on the edge, which includes still 1 billion people in the world who don't have access to electricity. It increases poverty. It increases mortality. You know, you're going to have people dying sooner. You know, you've got less health care. You know, the healthcare system we have is the result of our prosperity. It's because we build extra wealth as a result of our ability to use all of these, you know, inexpensive sources of energy to do all kinds of great things. And, you know, making people rely on more expensive energy is just going to reduce prosperity and increase misery and poverty around the world.
I don't even see how that is disputable, but it never, ever comes up in any discussions. And of course, I guess potentially it can't come up because you have newspapers in particular that are laying down the gauntlet and saying, we're not going to hear Dr. Roy Spencer, Dr. John Christie, or Dr. Anthony Lupo at Mizzou. We don't want to hear your positions that may challenge the so-called settled science. So you don't get discussions like that. And then you have this. I mentioned AOC, Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and presidential hopeful Beto O'Rourke.
The world is going to end in 12 years if we don't address climate change. And your biggest issue is... Your biggest issue is how are we going to pay for it? Mm-hmm. And, like, this is the war. This is our World War II.
This is our final chance. The scientists are absolutely unanimous on this, that we have no more than 12 years to take incredibly bold action on this crisis.
I can't even believe that that's being repeated. And more importantly than that, not challenged. I guess no matter where you might be on this issue, that is way out there on the fringes.
Well, it seems like every 10 years, we only have 10 years left. This has been, I've been around long enough to know that people have been saying this for at least 30 years. And it's just ridiculous because prosperity keeps increasing. Agricultural productivity around the world keeps increasing. And that's for everything, you know, all of the crops that humans produce. It keeps increasing on the same amount of land. I'm not talking about, you know, we're not having to plow up more land. We're producing more crops on each acre of land. So, you know, all of these things that were supposed to go bad have not happened. Severe weather events, they haven't increased. About the only thing that there is reasonable evidence for is that heavy rain events have increased, a small increase in heavy rain events, which is not surprising because the Earth has warmed. And, you know, as the atmosphere warms, the hydrologic cycle speeds up. You get more evaporation of water from the surface. And in order to have the whole cycle working, the whole hydrologic cycle, if you have more evaporation from the surface, you have to have more precipitation, okay? They go hand in hand. One has to match the other in the long term. But as far as storms go, tornadoes, I mean, this is the thing that's been coming up recently because we've finally got back into a period of more frequent tornado activity recently. But the long-term trend in tornadoes since the mid-1950s, it's gone down 50%.
So you've
violent tornado incidents in the U.S. has gone down 50%. since the 1950s.
So you've walked me into something. I've played this soundbite many times over the years. I played it one time, at least, when you were on. Richard Mueller, who is a physicist at UC Berkeley, and he used to be a climate change denier. He believes that we are the main cause. However, he wrote a piece several years ago that caught my attention, which was called The Truth About Tornadoes. It was in the New York Times. And he basically said, on the question of more tornadoes and all of these other things that are happening out there, no, it's not true. He debunked it. And then he also said this, because one of my questions, we're getting into what can you do about any of this? I said, well, what can you do? Can you stem the tide of climate change? What do you think? Can we stem the tide?
Suggestions to do something about it will not work. Partly because they're completely focused on the United States.
Yeah.
If the United States were to disappear tomorrow, no more greenhouse gases, the world emissions would be back where they were in 4 years, simply from the growth of China.
So, kind of launching off that, Dr. Spencer, even with the Paris Climate Accord, if you would do the things spelled out in the Paris Climate Accord, in Dr. James Hansen, some of the other real fathers and founding fathers of alarmism when it comes to the climate, they say that doesn't go far enough, would really not even make a dent.
That's right. James Hansen has said that the Paris Climate Accord is just, well, I'm not paraphrasing, I don't know, smoke and mirrors or useless. Basically, it does nothing. And people have run the numbers in peer-reviewed publications. They've looked at, okay, let's do the whole Paris Climate Accord and keep doing that for the decades to come. The amount of warming, even if you assume there's going to be a lot of warming from increasing CO2, the amount of warming that will be averted by the end of this century would be unmeasurable with our current technologies. Unmeasurable. It's just all politics. It's money. It's a transfer of money from the wealthy countries to the poor countries, which is why most of the countries of the world agreed to the Paris Accord. You know, it's because they are looking forward to huge transfers of wealth from the wealthy nations to the poor nations to somehow, I don't know, adapt to climate change. Do you really believe that that's where the money is going to go?
You know, one thing we should bring up, because I hear this from listeners when I have you on, and that's that this guy is bought and paid for by the oil industry. So your response to that is?
Yeah, I wish.
Right.
You know? I don't, you know, the oil companies have never offered me any money to do anything. And I personally don't care what their opinion is. I think oil company executives and boards of directors are gradually deciding to go along with the environmentalists and with governments because they're tired of taking the public relations hit. They know that they can come out and say, yeah, global warming is something we probably need to do something about, and we're going to be in favor of a carbon tax. We support the idea of a carbon tax. They can go ahead and do that, all right? And it won't matter to their bottom line because humanity still runs on fossil fuels. And who's going to pay the carbon tax? It's going to be the consumers when they buy their gasoline or whatever, or heating oil or natural gas. You know, they're going to pay for it, not the oil companies. So I really don't care what the, you know, fossil fuel industry's position is on this. It doesn't affect me.
More of Profiles coming up on KMOX. Now back to Profiles on St. Louis's News Radio, KMOX.
Dr. Roy Spencer, my guest on KMOX Profiles. And I don't know, you know, I haven't talked to you about this. Did you see the story on 60 Minutes a couple of months ago about global warming, climate change, and Siberia? Did you see that story?
No, I didn't.
Okay, it's interesting because it was about the Arctic permafrost that was thawing too quickly and some of the things they're thinking about. But in that story, and I fully expected, oh, this is going to be a climate change, we caused all this. But in the story, Scott Pelley was the one who did the story. He basically talks about how the reason that this happened is because of what they did in that area, I don't know how many years ago, but it was the permafrost went away because of all of the animals and the inhabitation and all of these other things. It wasn't because of SUVs and coal-fired power plants.
Well, what happens in the Arctic, you know, the Arctic has warmed faster, say, in the last 50 years than any place else. But the temperature in the Arctic depends a lot on weather patterns, because the Arctic would be way colder than it is now if it weren't for the fact that, you know, the oceans and the atmosphere carry excess heat from the low latitudes up to the Arctic to help keep it warm. And what that means is if there is any change in the heat transport from low latitudes to the Arctic, you can have huge changes in Arctic temperatures. For instance, the Arctic warmed up suddenly in the late 1970s because of a change, a natural change in the climate system, okay? It's just related to weather patterns, okay? The same thing happened back in the 1920s. There were accounts in the 1920s and 1930s of a rapidly warming Arctic, okay? They were seeing things that had never been seen before in human history. Sounds like today, right?
Yeah, right.
Except back in the 20s and 30s, it couldn't have been due to your SUV, right? And now we've got new estimates going back centuries of how much sea ice was in the Arctic based on there's this algae that grows on the bottom of sea ice, and when it dies, it falls down to the bottom of the ocean and gets buried in sediments. And they're starting to analyze these layers of old dead algae down in the sediments north of Iceland, and they're finding that it looked like sea ice in the Arctic started going away back in the 1800s just due to a natural shift in climate. So this is probably something that's been going, warming of the Arctic has probably been going on for centuries.
Yeah, in that story, here's I found the line from it because I pulled it up, but they said that, you know, you had the bison, the woolly mammoths, and horses and lions, and then when man became the main predator, the woolly mammoth and the other grazers were, you know, hunted to extinction. So the forests replaced the grasslands, and that made Siberia vulnerable to the warming climate because the trees trap more heat with gas. You know, it's interesting too because, or than grass, one of the suggestions is, and this was in this story, that they're trying to bring back the woolly mammoth. I'm not even joking about that.
Yeah, well, I think that would be cool.
So the other thing that happens here, and I've tossed this one out to several people, and I've certainly talked about it on the air. When it comes to settled science, Dr. Spencer, here's a story from the Associated Press, and its source is NASA, used to work at NASA. A major Greenland glacier that was one of the fastest shrinking ice and snow masses on Earth is growing again, a new NASA study finds. The Jakobshund Glacier, I'm probably mispronouncing that, was retreating about 1.8 miles and thinning nearly 130 feet annually, but it started to grow again at about the same rate in the past 2 years. So my question is, wait, what happened to the settled science? The scientists were quoted as saying, well, yeah, that was kind of a surprise to us.
Yeah, there's very little settled science in climate change. You know, getting back to the original part of your program about, you know, how I got into this business, I wanted to get into something that where there were answers. I didn't like wishy-washy stuff. I didn't like the social sciences, so I decided to go into science because I thought science had answers. Well, I probably should have gone into engineering, where they actually make things that have to work, because climate change is, our kind of science, you know, earth sciences, climate change, is sort of in between engineering and the social sciences, in that, yeah, we make measurements, but boy, there's a lot of disagreement and uncertainty about what we find. Not all science is created equal. This I like to tell people, climate science isn't rocket science. It's way harder than that and way more uncertain than that.
So what would we do for the future? Let's talk about recommendations, because my suggestion in all of this, if there are things that are going to happen from a changing climate, which there will be, we have to learn how to adapt. We're pretty good at that. But if we just keep forcing on the end of the world and we have to do these extreme things, then we're pushing off adaptation and maybe doing something about these challenges.
Well, that's right, and that's one possibility, is that the more we waste time and money on relying on technologies that are not, you know, are not mature yet, like for replacing energy, the less money we have to adapt. And this is why years ago, Bjørn Lomborg, a Danish environment, he calls himself the skeptical environmentalist. He put together a whole bunch of economists from around the world, some of which were Nobel Prize winners, and they came to the conclusion, it was the Copenhagen Consensus, I believe it was called, that where they said, you know, even if the IPCC is right about how much global warming we're going to have, it's better to adapt than it is to try to do something about it.
You've been listening to Profiles. If you missed any of this episode or want to hear other profiles, go to KMOX.com and click On Demand.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.